The Alabama Crops Report Podcast, your trusted information source for Alabama agriculture.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into the Alabama Crops Report Podcast. I guess we're in the roaming studios today. We're live from the Prattville Agriculture Research Unit in Prattville, Alabama. How about that? So with us today, we've got, of course, Simmer Virk, Blake Lanton, and then first-time guest, Miss Katie Nichols from Alabama Extension Communications Team. Katie, how's it going?
Hey, guys. Never done this before, so it's kind of exciting, and I feel like I'm part of an elite group now, so thanks for letting me join.
As you know, for all first-time guests, we have to ask them a question, because I'm sure you're a long-time listener. I saw this on the internet the other day. I thought it would be a perfect question. How many Rhode Islands can fit in the state of Texas?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
And we'll let the guys take a stab at it, too.
At least 40.
I don't even know how to guess. I'm going to go higher than Blake and say 45.
I got to look up a map of the U.S. to see how big
Simmer's got it pretty good.
Is that a bad disadvantage?
Yeah.
More than 40. More than 45.
Probably wow. Double that then.
221.
Jeez.
Okay then.
Wow.
That's how big Texas is.
That's how big Texas is.
Yeah. Or how small Rhode Island is.
I've driven through it a few times. It takes about a whole day to get through.
Yeah, just about.
Yeah, so I was about to say it takes like 12 hours to get through Texas if you go across the longest part. So maybe 45 minutes going across Rhode
Island. And you can comfortably drive like 85 through the entire state of Texas too.
Oh, there are
and they
signs
don't care.
That say the speed limit is 85.
Yeah.
That's my kind of place.
Yeah.
Burn it up.
All right. Well, so I think today we want to talk about maybe, you know, as we're recording, it's March the 5th. So we're probably some corn maybe getting ready to go in the ground if it hasn't already in South Alabama, and certainly will be by the time this comes out. But we thought it may be a good time to talk particularly with Simmer about, you know, planning preparation, making sure all the equipment's ready to go and those types of things.
Yeah, there was talking about corn planting, Seminole County. And Georgia is the very first one, and I saw pictures on Monday.
Yep.
They're planting corn.
Yep. Last year, I think there was some corn planted in February in Baldwin County.
There we go.
When we were down there for peanut meetings, they were rolling. So we just had basically the whole state last night had 40, 50 mile an hour winds and strong thunderstorms. So that might put some folks out for a while, or it may help. We'd gotten pretty dry in some places too. So it's about that time.
Yeah, so basically, you know, as Steve Spurrier would always say, it's talking season. So we've been doing our county and regional production meetings, and I figured it was a good time just for those people that haven't been able to make it out to those to kind of talk about what y'all had been presenting on. And I know it's probably a little late for soil samples, but Dr. Virks had some real good data on best soil sample management strategies. You know, talking about grid sampling and everything, I think most of your research has shown that the 2.5 acre grid is probably the best way to go in most cases.
Yeah, and it kind of goes to a lot of that research was driven in when I was in South Georgia because we had a lot of growers doing 5 acre grids or higher. So that started there. Interestingly, going across the state at all these meetings, you know, my first question I ask, how many of y'all are soil sampling and what size grid? Good thing that most growers who are doing grid sampling in Alabama are kind of in that 2.5 acre grid size. You know, I've heard some 5 acres, but that's where I kind of put them as a caution. Hey, you just may want to spend your money a little bit more wisely in a way that you may want to skip 1 year, but I'd rather do a 2.5.
What was the standard in Georgia?
Five.
You think?
Because of every year.
Every year. And I would assume their fields are probably less variable than most of ours would be. I don't know that. I've not spent much time in South Georgia. But
soil type-wise, those fields are pretty variable.
Okay.
The biggest thing, and that's why even in your meeting yesterday, I asked the guy about his crop rotation, because what I learned, and we actually have growers in South Alabama who are every year grid sampling, peanuts is the big thing that kind of, because we don't care about P and K in peanuts, only soil pH, and if you fail to address soil pH in peanuts, you would probably lose a crop on there, you know. So that's why they're just every year grid sampling, making sure the pH is right. So they're kind of in this loop, you know, every year, same grid size. But if you think about how much money is tied in soil sampling every year, I think that was one of the reasons over the years they're like, okay, I don't think we can do this 1, 2.5 or whatever. 5 is, you know, you break a 50-acre field, that's 10 samples, which is more manageable. If you're a 25, you know, that's a lot of samples. If you're 1 acre, that's 50 samples. So I think that cost thing up front kind of pushed a lot of growers over the years to just like, hey, just go ahead and sample on 5 acre.
But what's neat is that the information that you've shown is that you pretty much spend the same amount of money.
Yeah, because so you're not because applying. The mentality behind is I'm going to save money on soil sampling and soil analysis up front. Our research also included that what if you're doing it on a 5 acre, that soil sampling method is not doing a good job of picking the variability in the field, so now you're over applying in a lot of field and under applying, especially over application. Now you're spending more money on lime and fertilizer. If we take that money and put it back on what you had to spend on soil sampling, you end up being the same amount of money, right? You spend the same amount of money, but now not only your soil sampling is not doing its job, but you're also over or under applying fertilizer and lime in your field.
And it's harder to put a number to it, but if you're under applying, you're also limiting your yield potential as well.
Glenn Harris, he always kind of got on me when we were doing a lot of this research. We know what the over application is doing because you're putting a lot of money in fertilizer, especially potash and phosphorus and all that. He's like, how do we put a value to under application? I'm like, that's something we actually got to do a lot of testing or trials on. Like, if you were supposed to apply 60 pounds and you only applied 20 or 30 because of you didn't sample the right way, what is the yield, but what is the economic?
Mm-hmm. You know? And that's something to study. You'd have to do it over a 5 or 6 year period because the weather in a given year can impact that so much. It's hard or you get boll rot or exactly. Something, you know, it's hard to say.
Yeah. So going back to your point, I think most of our growers are in that range, which is good. So our all of that research, basically to summarize it, is if you're grid sampling, don't do it over 2.5 acres. Now, the other big thing, which we're trying to change some of the mindset of our growers. Because right now, when we soil sample or whether we're working with a consultant or whether someone's kind of doing their own, they take just that one grid size and put it across the whole farm. Every grower knows that they got some fields which are pretty highly variable and all that, and that's where we see even a 1 acre grid could help them do a better job. And that's where we're still spending a bunch of money on 1 acre grids, but then that's why we don't recommend doing that every year. It's like you do it the first year and then you go to some sort of zone base, which that could be a soil type or other data layers you have available, do a zone sampling, which still helps you manage the fertilizer, but you're not spending that much money on grid sampling. And every third or fourth year you go back to that grid sampling.
Yeah, that was going to be the next question. So basically, you know, if you haven't been grid sampling starting out, you want no bigger than a 2.5 acre grid, and then maybe a couple of years after that you can go to zone, and maybe your third or fourth year go back to that 2.5 to keep yourself in check.
And our whole goal is over the years, are we improving our nutrient levels in a way, but also doing a good job of managing, so that going back to every third, fourth, or I even say if you're doing a really good job of zone sampling, you can even push it out to the fifth year, you know, is to give yourself a check. Are you going in the right direction? Are you doing the things right way in the field before you start going, you know, because zone, you're only pulling 8 to 10 samples max in a large field even. So
well, going to that, I guess the most important thing there, you know, you can do all of this, you can do all the right soil sampling methods, but if your fertilizer rig's not calibrated right, or if it's not able to variable rate right,
that's one thing. And I don't know, maybe you guys can help me how to address that properly in a way. I think I may have, you know, offended someone at a county meeting, you know, my very first or second one. Do we need to pause it?
So we got a black hawk chopper about to land on us, I think.
Which I can cut.
There were some fighter jets that flew over last year when we were in the field. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Last sound of the bad guys here.
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess going back to the spreader calibration, and it goes back to we're spending a lot of money on soil sampling, or growers are, right? I have had growers who bring these books that the consultants or the companies bring in, put them on their table, and sometimes they tell me like, hey, I've got a $25,000 or $30,000 in this, you know, just for soil sampling, creating maps. What do we do from here, or how do I? But the biggest thing is we can do the best job of that, but end of the day, all that is still being spread with a broadcast spreader, which if it's not calibrated, then all that money spent and effort in making these good maps to understand is still a waste, right? So that's where the proper spreader calibration becomes pretty important. It's a time-consuming process, but we just don't have anything else to make sure that we're doing a good job of applying that. The thing that kind of comes in, becomes an issue in a way, growers who own their or who have their own spreaders are usually a little bit more diligent about taking the time and doing it. It's the co-ops, the fertilizer retailers, and all that. You know, they're running so many different blends, rates, and stuff like that. Not that we're probably giving a shout out to Greenpoint in a way, but I've heard that they're starting to maintain a database of different calibrations with different products and stuff like that they have performed, so that way if their operator is going out to do a certain amount, apply a certain product blend, they at least have a setting that they have tried or tested, that, you know. So I feel like something like that, but again, I don't know how many of our co-ops are really doing that. So at that time, it's not in the grower's hand, it's more of are the fertilizer retail points or the grower or co-ops are making sure that the spreaders are calibrated.
So next winter we're going to have calibration schools across the state, right? And we can come in, and
Eddie tells me back in the day they used to do this all the time.
Yeah it would be a very beneficial and impactful program, I think.
And you do have a couple of kits with all the calibration pans.
So from Auburn, Alabama Extension, that we're making sure that we provide to our regional extension agents so that they can help growers who actually do not have the resources, which it's a spread calibration kit, a very simple process. We have kits available through us for growers to, or even co-ops to utilize if they're interested in, you know, doing this, and we can we're there to support them, you know, whether that's providing them the documentation how to do this properly, or if we need to come out there and help them do it.
And you can just get up where your local county office or local county extension agent, and they can help you get that stuff.
Yeah, my plan is, in a way, right now we only have two or three kids, but maybe by next year we're gonna have six or seven regions in a way from extension.
Well, we've got six regions, and that would be seven agents when we have all positions filled.
So let's have each agent or each region have one kit, so that way it's local, it's there nearby.
And you could makeshift your own, right, with just some aluminum pans, and I would assume
you can. It's
better than nothing.
But I think those are pretty cost effective in a way where it's just easy to get them. They're standard. Spreader manufacturers sell them.
Okay. So, well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the planters.
So where we are today, I guess, you know, right now, timing wise, we should be planting corn here pretty soon. So I've done this in the past where even our research planters, I have taken them apart completely just to make sure we put the time and effort so they're ready to go in the field. So I think that would be one thing we really want to make sure that the growers are taking the time right now to look at their planters. And I'm talking about, when I said research planters, we only were dealing with 4 or 6 row planters. We got a lot of 12 row planters across the state. Blake told me he's got a 24 row planter.
You've got one, Blake?
I don't.
In his region.
Yes, yeah. There is one over in the Black Belt.
If you think about, you know, spending the time and effort, but if you think about it, we only make one planter pass.
Hopefully.
We're either happy with it, or we got to live with the consequences, or we come back second planet pass is costly, right? Every time.
Yep.
So we always emphasize you better make sure that everything's working right and properly when you make that one planet pass.
Yeah. You know, I told you this yesterday, but of all the cool stuff that you've got, the pretty maps with hot zones and whatnot, to me, the coolest thing that you have is the data on how variable row unit one can be on seating depth versus row unit three, sometimes over an inch of difference. And, you know, Steve Brown always jokes, but it's kind of true that a corn agronomist wants the corn seedling to pop up how far apart? Every 15 seconds is what he says. And of course, that's not really that close, but still making the point that with corn in particular, they do need to be very uniformly planted. And that information just really opened my eyes of how important it is to check every single unit at some point.
Yeah, and even Dr. Smith mentioned yesterday about trips and everything.
Yeah, which,
again,
yeah.
That's not my area.
That's right, but yeah. Even in cotton, if you've got seedlings coming up over 3 or 4 days, sometimes some of them get all the thrips movement and some of them completely miss it, and that can complicate decisions for foliar sprays and those kinds of things. So it is important in cotton as well, yeah.
Yeah, so what Scott's referring to there, the seed depth variability, you know, and maybe, Katie, that's where we can do an article on planter checklist, you know, different things to go through and all that. But is how common it is to have a seed depth variation across the planter, because our work kind of focused more on the top of the planter, just making that one setting same across the whole planter, where we're trying to actually make sure that our seeding depth is consistent, which is under the soil. So we got some recommendations on you make sure you check every row unit, and then your setting could vary.
Two and two ain't two and two across the whole
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. So and that's funny, especially our 12 row planter guys, when you ask them how many rows they're digging to check your depth, their funster answer is 12. And I'm like, well, how many are we really checking? They're like, well, maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah.
You know.
Which is what I would
which,
do. Too.
Which is a good thing. They know we should be checking 12.
Yeah.
You know. So well, that's why you don't want to get out in the field and start doing this the day that you actually want to plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the emphasis right now, this is the time to get on that planter and make sure that it's ready to go 2 weeks from now when you're ready to roll.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's the next thing to look at. You know, we're talking about seed. So I think one of the things you mentioned is one of the most cost-effective things that you can do is have a seed monitor.
Oh yeah, that's a no-brainer in precision ag technology. If I had to even, and it don't matter if you are a 100-acre farmer or if you're a 3,000-acre farmer, you know, planter mistakes, even if we do a best job, are pretty common, especially when we go from one field to other, or even when the soil type or stuff changes. If you don't have a seed monitor in the cab with you telling you what that planter's doing, you know, you're losing money. I usually say, the minute you make a pass in the field, the very first pass, that planter monitor starts paying for itself.
Yeah, going on from there, which, like you said, knowing how much seed you're putting out, especially these days, that's one of the
that's the greatest cost we have.
Seed cost is one of the big costs, right? Corn, cotton especially. And even we start to emphasize a little bit more using this technology in peanuts, because right now we may be okay with our peanut seed cost because it works a little bit differently, you know, than our corn and cotton. But how long do we have it? You know, right now our guys may set their planters at 6 and 7 seeds to the foot, but it's putting out 8 and 9. They don't care too much. I bet you they don't have the same mentality when it comes to corn and cotton. If they want, you know, 2 seeds to a foot or if seed and a half to a foot, they're making sure by digging that that's what's happening in corn or cotton. But the other thing I emphasize, the importance of planter technology even becomes more important, because now we're planting a lot of lower seedings. We're right on those seeding rates where we can't afford to have large skips or doubles anymore, right? I remember 5 years ago when I was doing all my PhD research on planters and stuff, and actually in North Alabama, we have growers, very high seeding rates, 38, 40,000, 43,000 on cotton, you know. at that, I think we're not as much as worried about is that seed spaced pretty well or not. But right now, we're more towards that 28, 29,000 where, okay, you miss one seed in a row, certainly you have a gap that is more than a foot. Now you're talking about having a yield effect in cotton.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen 19,500 plants per acre pick 1,200 pounds, but it was perfect where there was a stalk. Everywhere you put your foot, there's a stalk on your heel and on your toe. But that's hard, and that they did not intend to do that. It worked out, but that's hard to do.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing there is you want to watch each planter foot or seed meter. You want to have a, you know, a little bit of an estimate on each seed meter and not the whole planter across the board.
Yeah. So that's where we say you almost want to treat your each row unit as a planter. Right?
Yeah.
So, which means you're doing the best job of setting the row unit and treat it as that, you know, this is the planter I'm working with. And if you have a 12-row planter, now suddenly you got 12 planters you're working with in a way, because when we look at an average seeding rate across a planter, those 12 runners, guess what? Six of them could be under seeding and six of them could be over seeding, which means your average population is still the same, which we want. But what we want to emphasize is your and that's why I usually say you better have a quality seed monitor, which means that's telling you what is your seeding rate, singulation, and all that for each row. Because especially even on a 6, 8, or 12-row planter, I bet you there's always one or two row units that are just not doing what they're supposed to doing. And that seed monitor helps you catch that, let you stop, fix it before you go ahead and plant the whole field.
Yeah, having three extra plants and 3 feet on row one doesn't help you overcome having a 3 foot gap on row two. So you need to make sure down the row you've got what
exactly
you're supposed to have.
Each row has our target seeding rate.
Right.
You know, right in there.
Well, I'll push towards, since we're talking about seed and everything, you had some pretty good data with peanuts, Scott, about in-furrow treatments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we see a very consistent yield response in peanuts regardless of the at-plant insecticide in April, whether we used imidacloprid, Vidate, AgLogic, Thimet, didn't matter. We saw a very consistent 400 or 500 pound increase from having an at-plant insecticide. So we got into, you know, mid-May and into June, much less consistent. But in April, we need to have something go out. And even if you're not worried about tomato spotted wilt virus, we just still see from delayed maturity and the damage from thrips feeding themselves, we still see yield responses pretty consistently from having that plant insecticides.
So plant in April, especially
April through the first couple of days of May, I would
have something.
If it was
there.
Mine, I would have something out there for sure. And in cotton, you know, seed treatments this year are not where we need to cut cost. We had some information there too with a little over 100 pounds of lint and in 5 years of research trials at multiple locations. Again, regardless of what we use, as long as it was a recommended at plant insecticide, seed treatment or in furrow, we averaged about 100 pounds of lint over our fungicide only check. Because you can get a basic seed treatment, which has just a very small rate of the imidacloprid seed treatment on it for storage, but that is not enough. You want at least the standard seed treatment rate on there.
Yeah, I think that was the point that Dr. Ron was trying to make yesterday. Some of those delayed emergences, a lot of that treatment has kind of broken down or worn off by the time the plant comes up. So
once the seed imbibes or absorbs water to start the germination process, your clock starts on that seed treatment. And you've got 21 to 28 days, but that clock has started. And if it's 5 days delayed getting all the way up to, you know, to the soil, well, that's 5 days you lost that seed treatment. And so you want them to come out. And again, the timing of when the thrips flight is, I mean, it can just a day or two can totally change stuff there as well.
Well, I also had a grower ask yesterday, across central Alabama, especially in some of our reduced till, no-till situations, we have grasshopper problems. And he's starting to burn down pretty soon, but he said, you know, it may be a month before he comes back with the planter. So what could he do in his burn down to maybe help with the grasshopper populations? And I know we do have migrating adults that can still come back, but, you know, one of the cheap options that I told him, was Demelin.
Yeah, so grasshoppers are a challenge because they're very sporadic, both in where they are and also when they feed, right? Sometimes you may go out there and it's like the ground's moving. There's so many grasshoppers hopping around, they don't really touch the cotton that much. Sometimes they'll eat 5 or 6 acres. You don't know when it's going to be. And so one of our recommendations in fields with historic problems with grasshoppers is to throw in Demelin at burn down. Now, another complication with grasshoppers is they start hatching out in March, and they can hatch out through almost June. So you can have new ones coming out of those egg pods down in the soil for a long time. Then once you start getting adults in there too, that really complicates it. So if we're burning down a month before we plant, I would recommend some Demelin to try to kill those that are coming out now, because if not, we're going to have adult grasshoppers in the field when we do plant. But then I would also consider maybe looking at it, and depending on how much risk I'm willing to take, behind the planter, you know, within or so a week, plus or minus of planting, putting out another shot of a couple ounces of Demelin, maybe throwing in a pyrethroid or something to get some knockdown, because that Demelin is a growth regulator, so it doesn't kill them the day you spray it. But unfortunately, grasshoppers are just always going to be a risk deal. There's never going to be thresholds. It's just always going to be how many of them that you see hopping around out there are you comfortable living with.
And you mentioned pyrethroid. It's not going to have an effect on adults.
Well, it's very sporadic on it. It's good on the nymphs, on the immatures, but it's pretty sporadic on the adults. If we get into a situation where there's a mixed population and a lot of adults, you got to go with acephate at that point. And, you know, rate may depend, but half a pound up to maybe 3/4 or 2/3 of a pound to get good knockdown control of those adults. I'm hoping we can isolate or find a field somewhere nearby this year that we can do some little spray demos in and just try to, you know, see. But yeah, grasshoppers are tricky. And for some reason, Blake, it's like we're the only state that deals with them. And I don't know why. Well, now and then Georgia talks about them. But, like, when we have our meetings with all the entomologists across the belt, they're always like, all right, Scott, well, you're the only person with grasshoppers. So what'd they do this year?
Well, again, you know, spending 15 years in South Georgia, I never once even thought they were considered a pest.
Yeah, very rare.
And then my first year in central Alabama, the first field I walked into, a farmer was going to plant. And I said, well, I'll just, you know, ride over there and see if it's come up yet. I just wanted to see some cotton coming up out of the ground. And I walked out there, and they were coming up in droves in front of me. Man. And I said, well, we may have a problem here. I don't know if they ever would have done the damage, but there was enough where they could have ate a 100-acre field up. Yeah. You know, we got to do something now, and the airplane was spraying the next day.
Yeah. And something else important, I kind of alluded to these pods that they live in the soil, and that, you know, they're overwintering as eggs, which means – cold ain't gonna bother them, snow didn't bother them, you know, none of that kind of stuff. The only thing that's going to impact them is either tillage that mechanically kills the eggs, or if we feel like if it's been a really wet winter and the soil stays saturated for a long time, it can kind of drown them out. At this point, the weather's been so different. I don't remember if it's been a wet winter or not, to be honest.
It's been a snowy winter for sure.
Yeah, it's that one week anyway. You know, it's freezing cold 1 week, and then the next week you're wearing shorts and a T-shirt outside. So
January didn't seem as wet as it has in previous years. Now, we did get some torrential downpours recently and a few showers here, but I would say we're close to average, but probably not there.
So weather probably not going to impact overwintering very much, would be my guess. But I've always told, if you want to sound like an idiot, make a prediction about insects.
Yeah, that's all right.
All right, let's bring Katie in. She's been listening a lot.
In the hot seat.
So, Katie, tell us what is Alabama Extension doing on the communications? Let's back that up.
What's her role?
Tell us what your role is with Alabama Extension.
All right. So, I'm the news unit manager, and that sounds like it's just a few little things, but it entails quite a few. So, we manage the website, and we add anybody's timely information. We write news articles. We upload podcasts. We manage web pages that talk about events. Really anything that you can fathom when it comes to www.aces.edu. So I work with a lot of folks like y'all that are out doing work in the field to try to communicate what you're learning in a way that is both professional and easy to understand. And I think that's my favorite part of my job, is that it's never the same every day. I'm learning something new from y'all, or maybe I'm learning from the human sciences group, but it's something that is applicable to me or others. And so that's my primary job, is to take what y'all are learning every day and share it with other folks.
And you're across all teams.
I am.
One thing that I've been here 5 years and have been working with different extensions for longer than that, but I still struggle to wrap my head around just how big Extension is, yes. How diverse it is.
It's huge. We were at a training telling people how to help them better market their programs and events a couple of weeks ago. And I just started looking around the room and trying to remember who was part of what group. And I did a pretty good job, but there were a lot of people in that room that I either don't see all the time or talk to on the phone more than see them in person. And so Extension is huge. Yeah. And the hardest thing to wrap my head around is that there's something for everyone, whether you're filing taxes or planting crops. Raising kids.
That's what I tell people. I'm like, whether you're a 5,000 acre cotton farmer or you're somebody who's interested in how to budget for, you want to go on a trip somewhere and how do I budget for that? There's somebody in Extension that can help you with whatever you need.
Plant tomatoes in a bucket.
Yeah.
I mean, fun stuff.
Yeah.
But there's all kinds of information. So, the biggest thing that I like to do is to tell people that while they can, of course, call y'all. If y'all aren't available, a lot of the stuff that you write is available online. So the easiest thing to do is to go to aces.edu, and type in what you're looking for. And if you can't find it, then there's likely someone in your county office who can help you print that off and go home with something. And, of course, they can call y'all or call me. But we like to be able to send people away with something to help them take the next step for what they're looking for.
Well, today, I call it a digital extension, the need for today in a way, because traditional programming is still good. It works, right? We want to meet people face-to-face to tell them and all that, but not everybody's there.
Right.
And we got to find different ways to reach all these people. And example, this podcast is one. Not everybody listens to podcasts, but those who does, there's an avenue for them to get information.
Right.
And it's the same way, we're available through phone or other media, but the website is where if somebody don't want to, some days you're just not going to call anybody, talk to you, just like go search, hey, I want to learn about insect control or plant maintenance, something, and there's, if we have done a fact sheet or any article or something, it kind of pulls up right there. So it's just another avenue that all the information's right there.
I always joke that because I have two kids under three or three and one that call me anytime and I'm probably awake, but I'm glad we do have the website where
accurate.
They can actually go to and not call at midnight.
I can identify with that.
Yep. Yeah.
Four under three at one point.
Ooh. Well, all right. Well, this is Katie. We appreciate you
thanks
joining us
me.
Today. Blake, again, you, and thanks to Josh and Brady here at Prattville for letting us set up in the office to do our podcast. Simmer, enjoyed it. And for all our listeners, again, we always appreciate y'all tuning in. And if any of us can ever do anything to help, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know. Or if you have any topics or things that we want to talk about, or if you want to be on the podcast, just let us know, and we'd be glad to accommodate any way we can. So with that, we'll sign off and be looking for another episode soon.
The Alabama Crops Report is a production of the Alabama Cooperative Extension System.